Today we're going to wrap up the series and talk about self and self in relationships. And it's pretty hard to talk about self without talking about relationships. I didn't put our model that we've been using on the board today, but you probably still have some sense of it in your head.
Do you have any more sheets?
Yeah, there. Pat has a dozen. Oh, there are. I've got a couple more here too. So I don't plan to do any review today, but just move right into the area of self and relationships and. Starting out with self and then looking at relationships toward the later in the session and dealing with the model that I have on the board related to that. The thinking about the model that we looked at in the beginning with the balance, the equation, where the sense of self, self-esteem, is one of the components on the lower part of that equation, and it's looked at as a resource. And the sense of self can be a very positive resource, and it can help us to cope with the stressful situations that we are involved with or that we perceive. It can help us to acknowledge the problem, to name it, to understand it in a larger perspective, to share it with others, asking for help. In other words, it can be a resource which allows us to make some choices. But on the other hand, my sense of self, if it is a very negative, self-negating, it can be a stressor in itself. Now, Holly talked about this somewhat the last session when she talked about stressful situations that are experienced and then open up, sort of trigger memories or events in the past that have not been worked through or resolved. And I think we have a lot of those that we have just suppressed rather than resolved. So the sense of self can be either a positive or a negative. We ascribe meaning to all events, to our perception of the events. Let me give an example. A woman that I worked with who was depressed and hospitalized for depression because it was pretty severe, had been quite successful in our terms of success. Graduated from college, was working as a nurse, had a good career, had friends, but there were some problems that evolved in her life which she perceived as failures. And the failures were related to the expectations that she felt her mother had of her. And it was very interesting in the hospital. She would stay in her room and withdraw and refuse to have any involvement with the community, except when her mother came. And whenever her mother visited, which was about every 3 weeks, there was a great deal of anxiety. And she would use all her energy to look as good as she could for her mother's visit. And she would practically function as her normal self when her mother was around. And when we talked about this, she said her mother expected her to be a success, expected her to be functioning in this way. And because of some of the failures in her life, she had let her mother down. She could not live up to her mother's expectations. And when I asked her if she had checked that out with her mother, she said, no, Of course, that was what her mother expected. So one of the visits that her mother was there, we checked it out. We sat down, she and her mother and I, and checked out that expectation. It wasn't her mother's expectation. Not at all. Her mother was concerned about her getting in touch with herself, finding some meaning in her life, but somehow this woman had internalized that expectation and carried it with her, hadn't checked it out, hadn't reevaluated it, and it was still there. So whenever some dysfunction, some failure in her life came along, she plugged in the failure, not living up. Which I think says something about the need, our need to give up some of the old meanings that we attribute to situations. And we carry a lot of them with us. There are a lot of old scripts that keep going around in our memories, in our heads, in our perceptions of things. And we continue to grow, so we need to continue to reevaluate those old scripts and meanings and discard some of them as we change and grow. Some of you may remember in Janet's session on Kiss Sleeping Beauty Goodbye, where one of the things in the book talked about exercising one's mother. And there was a man in the group that raised the question, why does one need to do that? Because mothers are, you know, this image of mothers as being the good person, the all the things that we ascribe to the feminine image. And it was very refreshing to have a woman, I think in her 60s, wasn't she, Janet? Or, that spoke up and said, that's it, that's what I had to do. And it was such a freeing experience to be able to exercise that image, that the old scripts that she had from her mother, the guilt feelings every time she did something that somehow didn't fit her mother's expectations. And here she was in her 60s and had exercised that perception of her mother's messages so that she could then be free to discover some of her own. I also remember a medical resident who, when he discovered that he had cancer, which was a fast-growing tumor, his perception of that was failure. He was no longer a worthwhile being. And in a very radical move, he left medical school, he withdrew from his friends, his family, he lived alone, and he literally died before his death occurred. He just removed himself completely because he thought his life had ended. His perception of the event, the stress, the problem that arose in his life moved him in that direction. Somebody else, some other people I know, that when they discover they have cancer, there is a grieving process, yes, but in that process they find new strength and new challenges to live as full a life as possible during the period which they have left. So there are some very different meanings that we as human beings ascribe to the stresses, the problems, the difficulties that we face in life. If we remain helpless and weak and powerless, if our perception of ourself is that, then we are giving the control over to somebody else. Then we are dependent on others. And it's very easy to get it caught up in this with our shoulds and oughts and musts that we sometimes live by. Easy to defer the authority to somebody else. One psychoanalyst, Ariadne, talks about this theory as a dominant other, and he sees both men and women fitting into this. Women in terms of ascribing their identity and self-gratification from a dominant other, a person, being dependent on another for their sense of self, and men often ascribing it to their place of work or vocation, job. Well, I think what basically has been said, it's the acceptance and caring for oneself, loving oneself, how I feel about me, who I am. And the acceptance of oneself does not mean just a positive image of oneself all the time, that you're always looking through rose-colored glasses, because the acceptance of oneself as being human means accepting all dimensions, all aspects of the self, and some of them aren't very pretty. Some are pretty messy. We have a lot of imperfections and pimples, warts. Rick talked about this in the difficulty in not only recognizing them yourself, but then how and when do you risk sharing them with other people? Ellen Goodman had an article once on for Valentine's Day, which she talked about her aunt and uncle that had been married for 41 years, and she was curious as to what was the cement that sort of held them together for that long. And so she asked, and the uncle said that he modeled his own success on his father's, and that was, my father would get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say, you're no bargain. She says, I think that would make a hell of a Valentine. But if you start the day, she says, looking at your own flaws in the face, you might work up a pretty good appetite of gratitude before breakfast. If you know you're no bargain in the morning, by evening, you could be a twitter with appreciation for someone who actually loves you anyway. So the acceptance of self and all its aspects. I talked to somebody yesterday that was talking about her grandparents who had been married for 60 years. And their situation was quite different. She described it as a living hell. And you wonder what kind of images they are living with. There's a commitment there, but what are the self-images that they're living with when there's a real destructive kind of relationship? There are certain images of ourselves that tend to make us relatively free and competent. Brewster talks about this in his versions of the self, the metaphors of the self, the article that I had. We see this phenomena in politics, in the liberation movements. When you begin to tell people that they are or they have the capacity to be free agents, they begin to act more as free agents. The metaphors that we have of ourself become part of our world, part of our worldview, and we get this from our home, parenting, from teachers, church, school, whatever, our whole, all that goes into shaping us in our environment. And I think it's important to look at these preconceptions that we have of the self and how they influence how I think about myself, how I see my world, And this, the views that I have of myself can make a difference in whether my view is simplistic or impoverished, is incoherent or is fulfilling in some way. Images can be invented or created. Some are wonderful, some are pretty scary, and often we create caricatures and grotesques that take a part of us for the whole, which is a sort of reductionist thinking, I guess, as Larry would talk about, and try to capture the essence and range of both male and female in a word or phrase. What is important is to recognize what images we do live by. And I gave you a handout on just a potpourri of images and metaphors. There are many more that could have been added or that you can add yourself. Why don't you take a couple of minutes to look that over, and let's talk about what images of self work for you. I'm not prepared to get into any philosophical or theological debate on this at all. It's, like I say, a kind of potpourri, but what I would like is for some sharing of images that you live by that both work for you and don't work for you. Who's willing to risk starting out? Or reactions to some of the images on your paper.
Images of the self, images of myself.
Well, images of yourself. That's greater risk. I guess you can choose.
Okay. That's always a clue to me that I'm saying something that's hard to say. I also have a sense of myself as being huge, just really big. And I'm always surprised when people tell me, they ask me how tall I am, and I tell them 5'11", which is over the average height for the average American man. It's 3 inches over the average height. And so I think of myself as this enormous person. And people say, oh, you don't seem that big. I mean, I've heard that so many times, I'm always surprised that I think of myself that way. So filling that up, I have to be really feeling good.
Well, maybe you like Florida Scott Maxwell in the back here. Maybe it'll take you all your life to fill it up. She says, it has taken me all the time I've had to become myself. Yet now that I'm old, there are times when I feel that I'm barely here, no room for me at all. I think that is more of our focus. There's certainly psychology has focused us more on the individual than on the corporate. I think that's where Tillichen has the dialectic of moving from the self-identity to self-alteration. That tension between, so that you don't get too involved in introspection, so that you isolate yourself from the world out there and the concerns of community.
Another handicap, I think, that was pointed out to me by James Callison is our Greek way of thinking versus our Greek way of thinking, in that we try to define what everything in terms of nouns and definitions. And a great part of the world thinks in terms of verbs and an action. And the Bible was written by Hebrews, who called it action terms versus defining noun kinds of terms. It's hard to switch our thinking into those terms. We're so used to defining and saying, well, what is right? What is defined here? When they're speaking in terms of action or in terms of verbs. Doing rather than defining. So it's a whole new way of thinking.
So being
in terms of corporate being part of instead of individual. Individual defining versus corporate action. Being part of corporate and acting. It's a real mind-boggling for me to think in those terms and read scripture. Or thinking in terms of meditation or self. It's a whole different train of thought.
Our time is running out pretty soon, and I want to move into this model on relationships. We've talked quite a bit about relationships already in relation to self. Relationships are pretty central to our human life. We live in relationships all the time. We've come out of relationships in a corporate sense or community sense, living in families, in peer groups, communities. Relationships can be transient, sequential. They can be unpredictable. They can be related to a particular event. And there are cognitive and behavioral components, thinking and acting that go with it. They've been described as the real synapse of society. We use all our five senses in relationship when we are in an interaction with another person. And the perceptions that we have of ourselves, as we have talked about, often develop in social relationships where we are affirmed or negated, and how we feel about ourselves affects how we relate to others and how we interpret others' behavior. For mental health, high levels of social support are very important. And this is found in many different ways. Families for many of us, but some people don't have families or don't have families that are very supportive. Peer groups are very important, communities such as Holden and others. And also, let's look at relationships in terms of the pyramid. This is John Brantner's, who's a psychologist at the University of Minnesota. This is his pyramid of relationships, which I think is kind of fun to look at. When we talk about a one-to-one relationship, Brantner says there's no such thing as a one-to-one relationship, because when you sit in a room with one other person, it's very crowded. Because you interface with many different communities and many different groups of people. Each person in a one-to-one relationship brings a whole history of relationships, experiences of relationships to that encounter. Love, the top of the pyramid. There are very few, if any, relationships in our life that reach that. Some of us do, one or two, maybe more. Some never have any love relationships. What about friends? let me go back to the love relationship. Brantner describes the love relationship of such intensity that it can do some very strange things. It can bring out the best and the worst. best and the worst of things that happen between people. It can be very demanding. It can be supportive. It can be unpredictable. And it transcends all boundaries.
What does that mean?
It's hard to put any boundaries on a love relationship. Hard to establish boundaries. We can establish boundaries in the other areas, but with a love relationship, it just sort of squashes all fences. Whenever you put one up, it's knocked down. with the friend relationship, there is a mutuality, an expectation from the other, where I express needs to the friend and I also have needs met by the other person. There's a trust relationship that develops. Brantner tells a story about one of his clients, and I've had the same thing happen to me, where a person I'm working with will say, "You don't really care about me. You're just doing this because..." You've had this too, Holly?
I felt it.
You felt it?
I mean, in the mid-70s when I was seeing counselors for a while, and a couple of them, and it would almost be rote responses. I felt like writing out of a book. Mm-hmm. So I can see why people say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are counselors and there are counselors. There are some that probably give you that impression from the moment you walk across the threshold. But when this person said this to Brantner, "You don't really care about me," his answer was, "You're right. And aren't you fortunate?" Think about that. Which seemed like a pretty harsh answer, but what he was implying was that if he really cared, if he was on this friend basis, there would be a mutuality, there would be expectations from the other person that the other person could not give. So that the caring, he was implying different levels of caring, but really caring as friend or love relationship demanded some responsibility from the other person. So what he says in a counseling relationship, you're really operating more on the acquaintance basis. The acquaintance is kind of interesting aspect of relationship. It can be very intense in a short period of time, a brief kind of encounter. The duration is not significant. It's really independent of time, and it's non-demanding. It can be very creative, and it can be transcendent as well. There can be some mutuality within limits, and there can be a deep knowledge of one another. It can be used as a sounding board for building self-esteem. Do you agree with that? Used as a sounding board? You can have encounters with acquaintances where you can test something out about yourself or that isn't... Pardon? Probably so.
That's the positive definition of acquaintance that I've heard. Usually I've heard acquaintance and casual encounters kind of blended together. That's interesting to me.
Brantner really feels that that area is kind of little understood, or we don't give enough positive acclaim to that. There is more in that area of acquaintances that can nourish us and nurture us than what we have expected. I don't know, would you agree? What has been your experience with acquaintances?
Well, look at Holden Bill.
All right. And there's a lot of nurturing that goes on.
You almost get more positive stuff. Unlike friends who have to kind of put up with you through thick and thin, and I see the thin as well as the thick. Acquaintances tend to see you, you're on your best behavior. I mean, think about disillusioning when relationships between men and women start out as acquaintances and it's real wonderful, and then when it gets serious, then it starts to wear out. I mean, that high, wonderful stuff. That's why Holden is such a great point.
Well, I wonder sometimes whether our expectations are to have a lot of people in the friends area. Somehow we'd like to make a friend out of every other person we meet, and that's impossible. And maybe there's a lot of energy that goes into that when could do a lot with acquaintances and not expect it to move into a different level. It may, but not put that kind of expectation on it. Then the last one, casual encounters. Brantner says that we have about 4 billion of them in our lifetime. I don't know how he comes at that figure, but
4 billion.
Well, roughly
4 billion. Depends on how many airplanes you travel. How stationary your lifestyle is. And in this one, this area has been very little studied, but there's some very interesting things happen there, and I think each one of us can think about those kind of casual encounters that have been serendipitous and have just been a day brightener or given us a lot of good positive feelings, sometimes negative, but some very good things can happen there too. And in our whole sense of relationships, they may be very important. So, again, the sense of balance between different levels in relationship. Well, yes?
I just would like to say something. That is, the structure of the pyramid bothers me.
All right. It's a hierarchical.
To me, it's very hierarchical. And it doesn't talk about the energy that is possible from all of those.
Mm-hmm.
All of
mm-hmm.
those relationships, and it tends to then put the focus on wanting to get to the top rather than seeing all of the richness in all four layers. So
mm-hmm.
I wish there
mm-hmm.
was another way to put that, whether it's in a circle or
mm-hmm. we could put it in a
circle
mm-hmm.
or something.
Isn't it curious to have love? As I mean, those are non-comparable. Friends, acquaintances, casual encounter are people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. I think I've got three only in one apple.
Lover.
Yeah.
I think we better add an R to that. Yeah. Lover. Right, there. Again, it's just a model, but I think your point is well taken that a circle may mean something different. Just in ending, I know the bell is rung, but I'm going to read something from Powell in Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? Final word. The fully human person is in deep and meaningful contact with the world outside of him. He not only listens to himself, but to the voices of the world. The breadth of his own individual experience is infinitely multiplied through a sensitive empathy with others. He suffers with the suffering, rejoices with the joyful. He is born again in every springtime, feels the impact of the great mysteries of life, birth, growth, love, suffering, death. His heart skips along with the young lovers, and he knows something of the exhilaration that is in them. He also knows the ghetto's philosophy of despair, the loneliness of suffering without relief. And the bell never tolls without tolling in some strange way for him.